Thanks, everyone, for being here today. Our first order of business is going to be to approve the minutes from our last meeting. Members should have those in our packet. Do I have a motion to move those minutes?
So moved.
Representative Schultz moves the minutes of September 7th, I believe. It's had the date.
The 17th.
Excuse me, members. Representative Schultz moves the minutes for September 17th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. And members, today the focus of the commission is going to be on long-term care and what has been done and where that's brought us to this point, and then what needs are still out there for the state. And in the spirit of that, I am going to and have spoke with the co-chair, Senator Claussen, about allowing Representative Schumacher to have the gavel as he chairs the Long-Term Care and Aging Committee in the House. And so both myself and Senator Claussen will be here as co-chairs of the committee. But with Representative Schumacher's experience and work on the committee, he will be presiding over the commission today. So with that, I'll hand the gavel over to him, and we will go on with our agenda. Representative Schumacher.
All right. Thank you, Representative Mack. We do have a couple of other things on the general commission business. Are there any updates or review, additional review to the draft of the work plan? Mr. Schoenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark Schoenbaum from the Health Department. Just a couple of updates of research that has been underway related to the commission's work plan this year. And members may want to have that today's draft of the work plan in front of them. We have been seeking an update on the number of students enrolled in health professions education in Minnesota, and that data is collected by the Office of Higher Education out of a national database. Current information will be available at the end of this month, so we should have that for you next time. Similarly, there has been an interest to continue to fill in the details of what the state is spending on health professions education and workforce development. Complex subject, obviously, and House and Senate, HHS and higher ed. Fiscal staff have been working with us on that, and we should have more details for you next month. We're waiting for information from the Office of Higher Education, the University, MNSCU, and DHS, and progress is being made. There, perhaps turning to the work plan, given today's agenda and those outstanding items, the work plan, which I think is always considered a draft, has been modified so that those items appear as part of the November meeting, where we hope to have more details. Finally, the commission has continued interest in getting a handle on the number of people serving as preceptors in Minnesota. And we've heard pieces of that. You have another piece in your packets today, a memo from the Clinical Coordination Partnership from Liz Beal, who testified before you at an earlier meeting. We have both numbers from the organizations, education institutions that work through this training collaboration. And I think also of note at the bottom of the second page there, are some insights from Ms. Beal on the challenges on getting a firm handle on the number of preceptors. So we'll continue to try and fill that in as much as possible, but I thought it was helpful to hear from an expert who works with this these issues every day, that kind of getting some kind of clarity and definitiveness is probably never going to be entirely possible. But we'll continue to do the best we can, and those are the updates from me.
All right. Any questions? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question I have for you, also serving on the Capital Investment Bonding Committee. So having traveled around the state both 2 years ago and this year, I'm seeing increasing augmenting, not exactly preceptorships, but what they are doing is the digital mannequins and the digital experience rooms, where they're able to use video conferencing and a variety of things. It's a newer technology, but more and more schools. As a matter of fact, they have what we used to call them the dummies, or they're a smart dummy now. And so they have all kinds of things, and they're doing amazing things. So when we talked about this before, I think it's really important to look ahead to where things are going and not always make decisions based upon where they are, what we've kind of known. So could we be sure and maybe include that when we have that? Is that a future presentation or a future report?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, you'll be hearing later today from Health Force Minnesota, and they are deeply involved in all those kind of technology approaches to education. So I would expect that we will hear some information from Health Force on those issues, and we can certainly kind of fill in what else is needed following today.
Okay, good. That would be great. Thank you.
All right. Any other follow-up for Mr. Schoenbaum? Seeing none, thank you. Next we have Workforce Financial Assistance with the great Bob Held, who's going to come and present this morning on the Nursing Scholarship Program.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you for the kind introduction.
As always.
I'm Bob Held, Department of Human Services. I apologize, I've got a bit of a cold, so I've got a lozenge in my mouth, and my throat doesn't sound so good, my voice. At any rate, I'm going to talk about the Nursing Home Scholarship Program. I'm going to cover for you a little bit of the design of the program, the goals of it, and some statistics that we've got about the program and how it's trended over the years since it first came into place. In terms of design, do we have the overheads? Do I have to do something to so you can see my PowerPoint? I guess we're going to have to go with the handout.
And members, the handout looks like this if you need a reference.
I'm going to spend a lot of time discussing the design here very slowly because I was just told to stall. All nursing facility, in terms of the design of the Nursing Facility Scholarship Program, all facilities in the state are eligible to participate in this program. The participants, the scholarship recipients, all nursing home workers except the administrator, are eligible to receive scholarships as long as they work at least 10 hours per week on average or more. This used to exclude RNs and department supervisors. 2015 legislation removed that exclusion. The scholarships are for educational programs that will lead to advancement within the facility or within long-term supports and services. So any type of educational experience that will contribute to those goals is eligible, and the scholarships can cover things like tuition, fees, books, materials, and again, newly with 2015 legislation, associated transportation and child daycare. That means associated with the educational experience. Okay. The funding or financing of the program is essentially a purely cost-based model and always has been. The facility provides us data at DHS on what they spent in the prior reporting year for allowable scholarship expenses. That amount of money is reviewed. It's divided by the actual resident days. That comes up with a per-day dollar amount, which is added to their rate in the subsequent year after that report has been filed. So this has always been cost-based and done so with no actual limitation on it. So I'm on about slide 3. There we go. They're still looking at the wrong thing. The goals of the program, I'm on page 4 if you ever connected. The goals of the program have to do with enhancing facilities' ability to recruit and retain employees, to expand the long-term care workforce, improve the educational status of employees, provide a means of career advancement, and improve quality. So how would this program achieve those goals? Well, we view that there would be a couple things. There would be a direct effect, meaning that an employee who is receiving a scholarship, say a nursing assistant is being trained to be an LPN, which is a very common scenario, then they will be working as a nursing assistant but benefiting from the added training as they go through that course of education, and that should have an enhancing effect on the work that they do. And it's also perhaps a reflection of the management of a facility that wants to undergo the efforts to make this type of a benefit available to their employees. Yeah, there we go. Well, no, that's not the right. Yeah, I guess it is. Okay. So the some statistics about the program, the people in the most recent year that we have data available for is 2014. 84% of the scholarship recipients were female. The age of the recipients, 77% are between ages 21 and 44, and most of the rest are between 45 and 64. So it's relatively the younger females that are working in the nursing home that are benefiting from this program. The jobs that they are currently in, 55% are currently working as they get the scholarships as CNAs, certified nursing assistants, and typically they are taking a program to become an LPN. LPNs are the second largest group with 25% of the recipients, and they're typically taking a program to become an RN. So what we're doing is, through this program, we're assisting the nursing homes in financing their entry-level employees to advance to a professional-level type position. In addition, about 7% are TMAs, which is an enhanced form of a CNA, a therapeutic medication aide, also to become LPNs. So the program has changed in the years since it began. It was enacted in 2001. 2002 was the first year that it was in operation. There were actually 3,000 people that participated. That's gone up and down a little bit, but in the most recent year, only 1,040 people have received scholarships. It did go up again around 2008, 2009, and then has been steadily going down in terms of the number of participants since then. We've wondered why that might be. We theorize that from the facilities perspective, it's a very challenging program to operationalize. It may have started out big because of a sort of a backlog of people that would be interested in this. And our hope is that the changes from 2015 being less restrictive and broader in the benefits would result in some growth to the amount of recipient participation in the program. In addition, the number of facilities offering scholarships to their employees has declined as well. The 413 that you see for 2002 was essentially all nursing facilities because it was done through seed money where everybody got money into their rate to start it for a couple years. And then after that would get into a cost report, it was based on actual cost. So it immediately went down to from 413 to 306 and has now gone down by about a third from that to 196. We do have seed money available again from 2015 legislation and anticipate 20 to 30 facilities that currently look like they're going to start participating in the program again. And in terms of expenditures, that's gone down from the first year by a third, from $3 million to about $2 million. In total, $38.5 million has been spent through this program. That's not Medicaid state share, but that's total spending for the scholarship program. So how about some of the quality indicators? The first one would be direct care employee retention. That's one of the goals, is to accomplish that. And you can see in looking at this table that the retention rate for facilities that participate in the program has, in 2014, is slightly higher than for facilities that do not participate, between 1 and 3%. Considering that there's only 1,000 people receiving scholarships, that's about what I would expect to see. In terms of clinical quality indicators, the participating facilities had slightly higher average quality indicator scores, and you'll see on the next page also even more slightly higher scores in quality of life. And with that, I would be open for any questions.
Any questions? Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question on the retention. Do those rate comparisons, does that mean that they were retained by the specific nursing facility where they were working when they went through the training, or does that just mean they were retained within a nursing facility within one of the 413 facilities, or were they kept specifically by the facility where they did the training?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, it's the actual direct care employee retention of all facilities in those job classes in all facilities are compared. So it's not specific to the people receiving scholarships.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one other question. Is there any type of requirement if somebody uses the scholarship or a facility uses the scholarship that that person needs to stay within direct care services for a certain amount of time, or if they were to, you know, move on to a hospital or whatever it might be, it doesn't matter either way. Is there any incentive or requirement for that in order to access the scholarships?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, the program itself does not have any requirements of that sort. There are some facilities that choose on their own to be a little more restrictive in that way.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up then. So it's up to, that's not something that DHS regulates or anything like that. It's the facility that says if you want access to this scholarship, you have to be with us for 2 years, 5 years, however the case might be. It's up to each facility to set those standards. Is that what I understand?
Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, yes.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Held, on the very first page on the scholarship program design, it says on what I have written here, it says all nursing facilities, I'm assuming this is skilled nursing facilities, nursing homes, long-term care type facilities in the MA program. So is it exclusive? Are there any nursing facilities that are not part of the medical assistance program?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, about 3 to 4% of nursing homes in Minnesota that are licensed as nursing homes do not participate in the Medicaid program. So we don't set their rates. We can't deal with them as regards the scholarship program. So that's why I described it in that way.
I just,
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to be sure that I did have the context there. The other thing is that we have a loan forgiveness program as well. So how does the scholarship and loan forgiveness, do they work in tandem with each other? Is there any correlation with those two?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I didn't note it in the handout, but one of the new 2015 benefits of this program, well, there's a couple additional ones that come to mind. One is paying through the scholarship program for CNA training and testing costs, and the other is the costs of student loans. For I don't remember if it's LPNs or both RNs and LPNs, but I know for RNs who are newly hired and recently graduated. So you can't, for example, the facility can't pay them the full debt of their scholarship, of their student loans, but can pay them the annual costs of their payment towards that through the scholarship program. There may be other loan forgiveness programs that are not part of the scholarship program.
Okay. That's, well, I think maybe as we kind of bring these things up, maybe some of our experts, Mr. Chair, can inform us more about how those might work together or conflict, because I think we should have a total picture of what's happening here. It's so easy sometimes you get a piece of something and a piece of something and to know how they actually relate to each other. But I know we have a lot of experts in the room, and when they hear our conversation, I'm hoping maybe they will address it as part of their presentation, if that would be okay.
All right. Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Okay. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you at all track the individuals who have completed the program, gotten training, and to find out how long they do stay at a nursing home versus going to another healthcare facility like a hospital or healthcare system or health insurer?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't. We've talked about doing that, and we haven't been able to pull that together and do that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair,
Schultz.
I'm sorry. I made a note, and I'm on a different spot. I just want to comment that in my district, we have a large skilled nursing facility, a lot of nursing home in our area. But what they said was that the reform that was done on the payment system for nursing homes has had the most powerful effect in attracting CNAs in particular, LPNs as well, but other staff in general, because they're able to be more competitive with the market in regards to wages that they pay. And they are just so absolutely appreciative of that. So you can do scholarships and loan forgiveness, but if your base salary is so totally uncompetitive, retention is very difficult and hiring is very difficult. When you go to McDonald's and Burger King and some of these other places can make, you know, 30% more, that makes it very difficult, especially as the economy recovered. But anyway, they just said anytime you have a chance to tell anybody, tell them thank you for that reform. It meant a lot.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. We'll be addressing that a little bit more in detail later on in the hearing as well. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could go back to the slide on how participation in the program has changed. I was just crossing some numbers, and we started out very high, 3,000, and then there was another peak, 2008, it looks like. And in 2008, 3.8 million was allocated, and then there's a significant drop off. 2009, the number actually, the expenditure went up. So what's happening that we're spending more and getting less? And can you tell me what happened, what's causing that participation drop-off.
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, we don't know with any great certainty why the number of people has gone down. We speculate it's because it's a difficult program to manage and for the reasons that I mentioned earlier.
And so but then, Mr. Chair, where's all the money going?
Well, in terms of the amount of money having gone up a little bit when the number of people went down a little bit, it was probably that the average cost of programs that people were doing went up.
Senator Benson.
And then going
there's no limit to how a scholarship can be other than what it's for. So when you think back to what was going on in 07, 08, and 09, my guess is people were going back to school for much more intense long-term programs and maybe, well, obviously it wasn't more people, but maybe it was more of them that were doing that rather than shorter-term programs.
And
Senator Benson.
And Mr. Chair, so who decides who gets the scholarship then? Because if it's not about meeting the needs of Minnesota's workforce, I'm not sure why we're investing in that. If they're choosing the most expensive programs and we're getting fewer participants, I really worry about the efficacy in building a foundational workforce.
Mr. Held.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, when I said more expensive programs, I meant something like an RN program as opposed to, you know, something that might be a one-week-long program with a certificate that would result in a 10-cent wage increase for the employee. So there was another element to your question that I think I might have lost track of.
Senator Benson?
That's all right. Mr. Chair, if we could move on to retention rate comparisons. You indicated the differential in the retention rate was about what you'd expect for only 1,000 participants, but the differential in rate retention, even when there were a lot of participants, is insignificant. It's been a long time since I've had a statistics class, but if you just run the numbers between all job classes in participating facilities and job classes in non-participating facilities, if you compare those bottom numbers and take the average, there's 0.2% differential over time. And there are years where the non-participating facilities actually did better than the participating facilities in retention. And so I would really like to challenge this committee to, if the purpose is retention, why wasn't this designed to make people stay if they're going to gain the benefit? And why isn't it limited to what is essential instead of whatever the individual wants? We're spending, in terms of the human services budget, I know it's not much, but is this the most effective way to build the workforce that we need? I would challenge that it's an effective tool for retention, just looking at the numbers that you gave us and then looking at the correlation, the quality scores. There is a difference, but I don't know that it's, if we look at the number of dollars that we've spent, is it actually giving us a return on investment? Are there other ways we could improve quality and retention? And I have nothing against this program in particular, but you gave us numbers, and now I have to ask the question. If this is your best shot, do we need reform instead of just asking for more money? And so if you could address some reform ideas you might have had as you examine this program, ways that we could actually improve the quality score and retention, I think this committee would like to hear some ideas. At
Mr.
least
Hill.
I would.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, in 2015 there were reforms made to this program, and it would be interesting to see what the effects of those are. I really feel like I can't give you a good answer in terms of these statistics and the goals. I'm kind of hoping that some representatives from the industry will have some insights that I'm not necessarily aware of, And in terms of ideas for further reforms, I would wait and see how the current reforms play out, assuming that the program continues to be provided.
And Mr. Chair?
All right, thank you. Senator Benson.
What were the reforms in 2015?
The reforms expanded the eligibility for receiving a scholarship to include RNs and department supervisors who, until 2015, were not allowed to be funded through this program. It also added the loan forgiveness and the CNA training and testing, and it added some seed money for facilities that had allowed the program to lapse to kind of get started with it again. And it added expense eligibility for transportation and child care expenses that are associated with the educational program.
All right. Any follow-up, Senator Benson?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Bob.
Mr. Hyde, how does that help us with retention?
Well, the reason why we thought there would be a relationship to employee retention is that while you're receiving a scholarship, you'd be more likely to stay on the job until, you know, at least until you finish the program. Presumably, the facilities will have some interest in providing scholarships to people who want to advance into a skill set where they need staff. And I believe, especially in rural areas, RNs are very hard to recruit and retain. But admittedly, somebody's going to become a new RN, and they may want to have a hospital experience. And one of the things that I hope will have been the case is that they will have had experience in long-term care and will have had a good experience in long-term care and may want that hospital part of their career and may want to come back to the nursing home setting or other long-term care setting to continue to pursue their career.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Benson would.
I would just say, hope is not a strategy. So
this sounds like something that we can take offline as well and continue with the discussion. We do have a couple more on the list. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the interest of time, I won't ask for, I guess, a lot of feedback, but maybe just encourage the department. It sounds like. You need more feedback from facilities at this point. I don't know if you've done much research in terms of the facilities that are participating in terms of researching why they're participating, why their participation may have lapsed, and what their experiences are administering the program. I guess I heard in the testimony that perhaps there's some feeling that it might be cumbersome for facilities to administer. How does this work with other regulations we may be putting on facilities, and how do they need help or support or different strategies to administer the program so that it can be more effective? I won't ask for a long answer, but has the department done that kind of research yet, or are you planning to?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, we have had a little bit of research that we've done, and that's why I was able to give you these numbers today. We haven't pursued in-depth research into this program, no.
Okay. Any follow-up? No. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Held, I'm going to refer to the retention rate comparisons as Senator Benson did as well, but I'm also going to first go to the job position slide that you presented. Can you give me just a kind of an estimated pay range for a nursing assistant, an LPN, and an RN at a nursing home facility?
And before you get to that, Mr. Held, I'm going to let the committee know that we're going to move the home and community-based scholarships to the end of the agenda, so the long-term care imperative people, if they can be ready to present here in a few minutes. Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I'm going to just have to go off of a general sense. We do have those numbers. I didn't bring them with me. And there is geographic variation in them as well. but nursing assistants, I believe, are typically paid between $10 and $12 an hour with a lot of tenure, perhaps more. LPNs, I believe, are paid around $17 to $20 an hour, and RNs about, I believe, about $25 to $30 an hour.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Held, is there a
Representative Albright.
Big disparity between those pay ranges that would be provided at a nursing facility and in a hospital setting?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, yes. Substantial disparity.
And do you have any understanding in terms of what that disparity might be in terms of percent or dollar amount?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, a few years ago I looked at what it would cost to increase just RNs in nursing homes to equal scale with hospitals on average, and it would have been a 56% increase in costs.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I share Senator Benson's dismay at kind of the flat line, no pun intended, for the retention rate comparisons of the various classifications. It doesn't seem that we've gotten much traction out of this scholarship program for the amount of money expended. And in your conversations with the questions that have been posed to you, it seems like for 12 years worth of experience in this program, there would have been a little more data that had been collected on these various classes that would have been provided to the committee. And maybe it's available and it's just not here today. But it seems for 12 years, expending $38 million, I don't think the ROI on this program has been sufficient to consider a raging success. Would you share that concern?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I guess my sense of the program is that there have been, I didn't add the numbers in that table that shows the number of people that have gone through the program. It's, 2,000 to 3,000. No, I'm sorry. That's the facility table. I do have a total. 25,000 people have gotten scholarships in this program, and the majority of them have gotten scholarships to become from a nursing assistant to being a professional nurse. And I think that that's been a worthwhile investment. Even if they choose to work in a hospital instead of long-term care, they're still healthcare workers. Their lives are improved, and I think there's some value in that.
One more question, Mr. Chair.
One more question, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In a scholarship setting, particularly as one would want to advance their career, it would seem to me that the entity that is supportive of that scholarship would want to realize the benefit from that scholarship. But you have led me to believe that there's no agreement in place, employment agreement or otherwise, to hold that scholarship participant to the job or the job acquired after the scholarship for some period of time to realize the benefit. Is that not true?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, what you said is correct.
Representative Schultz.
There is no required agreement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want clarification on the retention rate chart. Are these only RNs? Are these all RNs at a participating facility, or are these RNs that have participated in the scholarship program?
When you look at just the RN section, and this would be true of the LPN section of this table and the CNA section of the table, it's looking at taking the entire industry, all nursing homes in the industry, whether they participate or not, and all of their RNs, and so grouping all of the facilities into two groups. Either they participate in the scholarship mm-hmm. program, regardless of how much, or if they do not participate. And looking at all of the RNs in each of those groups separately and saying, okay, this is who worked in the facility on day one of the reporting year. Of that group of people, how many still work there on the last day of the reporting year?
So we don't. It's not a breakout of who actually did the scholarship. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. So it's not a breakout. It's all RNs, whether they participated or not, at the participating facility.
Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's correct. It's all RNs at participating facilities compared with all RNs at non-participating facilities.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, so I'm really reluctant to make any conclusions if it's that way, and we do need better data on tracking those that have completed the scholarship, because what we have could be, there could be many other things going on in these retention rates that are correlated with why they're leaving the facility. So we definitely need better tracking data. One more question. Of the $38 million that was spent, how much of that is state money?
Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chair, Representative, of the $38 million, approximately 35%, in other words, $14 million or so, would be state share of Medicaid spending. Equal amount would be federal match to that, and then the remaining would be private pay or other payers.
Thank you.
All right. Chair Clausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has really been answered, but just a comment. I think there are a lot of good questions that are being raised here. I agree that I think we need a little bit more data to look at this, but I'm hoping that some of our testifiers today can speak directly to this about the benefits perhaps they've received by employees going through the program. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Held, for taking your 10-minute presentation and making it 40 minutes. You're always a surprise to me, sir.
Thank you, sir.
And to that point, that's why we are moving the home and community-based scholarship program to the end of the agenda, just because the next group that we have traveled quite a long ways to be here, so we want to make sure that they have their that they are able to get in their time as well. So if the long-term care imperative could come down and offer their presentation. And if you could announce your name and who you represent for the record, that would be appreciated.
Sure. Good morning, everybody. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Adam Sumala. I'm the Vice President of Membership and Strategic Affiliations at Leading Age Minnesota. We're a statewide association driven to transform and enhance the experience of aging, and also a founding member of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Our members are over 1,000 organizations throughout Minnesota, including nursing homes, assisted living residences, adult day service providers. And regardless of the part of the state that I go to, regardless of what type of organization I go to, hands down, the biggest challenge I hear from our providers is the recruitment, the retention, and the training of an adequate supply of compassionate caregivers. So I was really pleased that you're having this conversation today, and very pleased that we saw so many meaningful policy solutions come out of the 2015 legislative session. The expansion and I think piloting new concepts for the Minnesota Nursing Facility Scholarship Program that Mr. Held referred to, the new payment system that Senator Kiffmeyer referred to, expansions for the loan forgiveness, and the creation of a home and community-based services scholarship program, which you'll hear from Will Wilson in a little bit today. And I'm pleased to share just a little bit of background on another tool that launched this week, which is the dual training grants from the Office of Higher Education and the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. As fast background, I'm sure you're all able to remember what I consider to be the best acronym in Minnesota state government, which is the Private Investment Public Education Labor and Industry Experience, or PIPELINE. So created in the 2014 legislative session, it was designed to expand dual training and registered apprenticeship in four areas: advanced manufacturing, agriculture, information technology, and healthcare. The philosophy of applying skills that you learn on the job at the same time that you're applying those or learning those skills in your classroom or your education experience is wonderful. And it's not totally foreign to healthcare. For example, the nurse getting their clinical experience on the floor. However, registered apprenticeship program and dual training is pretty rare in healthcare. So what the department has done a really nice job of is creating these healthcare industry councils, and I was involved in those as well as the competency councils, and there were some very thoughtful conversations around different careers. There's an inpatient and outpatient mental health piece that Health Force Minnesota was very helpful in establishing. And probably the most prominent registered apprenticeship program that Minnesota has in healthcare was the health support specialist. And I think you have a brochure for the HSS program that's gone around, kind of an orange-colored brochure. And just as quick background on that, this is an example of what registered apprenticeship can look like in the field of aging services. It's 7 college courses. It's 9 college credits. It's 2,500 hours of on-the-job learning. So in those different domains that we feel will make a big impact on not only increasing the quality of services provided to older adults, but the pride, the recognition, an increase in wage, all of those pieces which really make a big difference for the retention and the quality. So starting this week, actually yesterday, the department announced an application for the pipeline dual training grants. I feel like these really have the opportunity to help transform people's lives out across Minnesota. The applications are out there. There's about $970,000 that are in this first round. Next spring, I think we're looking at about a $2 million round of funding that's going to be available. The department's estimating about 36 different applications. They are capped at $150,000 per employer, and they're also capped at $6,000 per employee. As an example, for our health support specialist program, the tuition expense for 9 college credits is under $1,900, which is a pretty darn affordable program, I think. We've had some great partners with the Minnesota State Colleges and University System. So going forward, the pipeline project is looking at expanding those occupations based on what does market research say, what are employers asking for, and what do we know society needs going forward. The focus to date has been around entry-level careers, as well as emerging careers, new things that are coming into being, which, as we know in healthcare, it changes every single day. So we're also looking at folks then, by default, in high schools, in colleges, career changers, people that are incumbent employees that are looking at developing and working their way up through the pathway within their organization. On the whole, this project through the pipeline, through the dual training grants, I feel it's allowing our state to create employer-based training programs and standardizing occupations across the state for those new and emerging pieces. It's good for employers, it's good for employees, and it's great for the people that we serve. So I know we're running short on time, Mr. Chair, so I'll be happy to take any general questions around the aging services workforce environment, around the dual training programs. I know you have some phenomenal providers from around Minnesota, so I want to make sure that you have time to connect with them today.
All right. Maybe if we can save questions until the end of the series of presentations, so if you can be close by, we'll take those at the end. Next, we have Arlen Swanson from Maple Lawn Senior Care. Welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
My name is Arlen Swanson. I'm the administrator and CEO at Maple Lawn Senior Care in Fulda, 3.5 hours from here, and in the chairman's district. Mr. Chair, I'll read this so I don't forget anything. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Arlen. I just said that. Maple Lawn is an independent nursing facility, and we also offer assisted living and senior housing on our campus. It's my pleasure to have the opportunity to thank you all for the work you did this past legislative session and to have the opportunity to share with you the exciting things we're doing at Maple Lawn. As soon as the nursing home reform language was signed into law earlier this year, we sat down to determine what we could do to assist our staff. Since wages have lagged so much, our first step was to provide a 10% across-the-board wage increase for all staff at our facility in early July, basically as soon as we could get it out. This is something we chose to fund from our reserves, since, as you know, the actual rate increase doesn't start until January 1st. We had been very closely monitoring our reserves and using them to replace our nursing home losses the last several years. We were fortunate to have enough left in reserves to invest in our workforce in anticipation of this rate increase. We will be reviewing our wage scale in order to provide necessary additional wage increases after the January rate increase begins. We also plan to retool our wage scale system in order to once again provide routine and annual wage increases to our staff. The anticipated rate increase has also allowed us to more adequately staff some positions. For example, we've hired a person to be our quality coordinator a position previously held with a registered nurse, and this frees her up to do what she does best, caring. There are many other ways in which we have been able to improve staff benefits and plan for the future. Importantly, in October of 2014, we discontinued our group health plan because it was no longer sustainable or affordable, and we replaced it with a premium reimbursement type plan that we subsequently learned was incompatible with the Affordable Care Act and at risk of penalties after June 30th. Mm-hmm. So fortunately, your reform legislation was passed just in time for us to reinstitute a fine and affordable group health plan, which started this past July 1st. On September 1st, we increased our company match for our 403B retirement plan. This benefit is extended to both full-time and part-time employees at Maple Lawn. Looking ahead, we are laying plans to expand our sick time benefit. We also have facility upgrades that have been on hold and are now on the move again. Now, despite all the positive impacts of the legislation, I do want to temper some expectations. Maple Lawn was fortunate to have had some carefully guarded reserves to release and pre-fund the changes I've just described. Many facilities are not in this position, and their staffing policy changes may not materialize until 2016 as the rates begin to provide the capital needed. As positive as the new rate system should prove to be, it's coming at a time of dire labor shortages. I'm afraid the largest short-term benefit of this may only be that staffing is stabilized for a while. Our local papers are full of job openings for caregivers in our side of the state, and I think it's statewide. Hopefully, however, over time, caregiving organizations such as ours will become more attractive employers with wages and benefits in line with the critical importance of our profession. Hopefully, Minnesota will retain its position as the leader in fine quality senior care. To illustrate my caution on expectations, the recent 10% increase I gave to our facility CNA starting pay raised it from $10.11 an hour to $11.13 an hour, still very far short of competitive in our area for even farm laborers at $13.50. But I must say the pay increase was certainly well received. It will take some time to improve our workforce. As the funds allocated by the bill begin to trickle down to the roots of our caregiving organizations in the coming years. It will take some time for pay levels to become competitive and benefit programs to improve. As befits the importance of our mission at Maple Lawn, we want to be the employer of choice, not the employer of last resort in the area. And it will also take some time for senior care providers to switch from the self-preservation mode we've been in to provide the care and services needed and demanded by Minnesota seniors. So thank you again for your vision and for an improved payment system. It is undeniably better to lead an organization when there is light at the end of the tunnel rather than the darkness of a brick wall. I have a couple comments on the scholarship program. I was quick to take notes here, if that's okay. My sense of the scholarship program is that it's part of feeding into a statewide employee base out in deep rural. I guess we're not deep rural anymore. That's gone away now. Out in where I live, we've probably ran about 30 to 35 people through the scholarship program in these years, and we've been a participant actively. But in our area, of course, lots of times it's the younger people, and they're getting their RN or their LPN, and they're moving hopefully into Minnesota somewhere else. They don't always stay at Maple Lawn. But a good anecdote is my director of nursing was an LPN that came to our facility, went through the scholarship program, got her RN, and now she's my director of nursing. And so for our facility, it was wonderful. I'm not sure if that's the only thing that kept her there or anything, but we have trained a lot of people that have gone into this caring profession through our facility. And where they all ended up, I don't know, but that's just an anecdotal thing that I would like to pass on. I think that there was a question about cumbersomeness. I think it's only as cumbersome as the policies that a facility writes. I think some facilities have written complicated policies on it. We've had a pretty open one to help people get in. I've had to convince some nursing assistants to do it. And so by having it at this level, the scholarship program at the facility level, I've been able to say, you really can do this. You can do this. And, you know, they're at CNA. They've not used to be thinking that they can do something. And we've encouraged people to get into it. The only downside is we lose CNAs, which are kind of at a premium right now. So we've moved people up and out of those beginning positions. So with that, I'm
All right. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Swanson. If you can stand by, too, for questions at the end of this segment, that would be appreciated. Next, we have Shelley Wiggin from the Minnesota Masonic Home Care Center. And Ms. Wiggin, as you're approaching, if you could please state your name and who you're affiliated with for the record and give us your testimony.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Shelley Wiggin, and I am the administrator at the Minnesota Masonic Home Care Center in Bloomington. In addition to being a skilled nursing facility, Masonic Home is a campus which offers assisted living, memory care, independent senior living, and a variety of rehabilitation services. I, too, want to thank you for passing the nursing facility payment reform package last session. When the legislation passed, we sat down immediately and said, wow, what can we do with this? It will and already has had a positive impact on our facility. We have struggled with so many positions the last 16 months. And at the time we heard of this passing, we were struggling with dietary. I had 26 open dietary positions at the end of August. Mostly because it's a transitory position, the dietary aid, they go back to school, they go back to college. In the past, that we always have a large amount that leave that time of year. This year, there were the replacements. So we decided to implement a wage increase right away. Even though the funding isn't coming through, we put in one. We're going to do additional ones as well. That did help. We are now almost fully staffed in dietary. We did a lot of other things as well, like lowering the starting age to 15, the problems with that. But it's just the staffing shortage is the worst I've ever seen. I'm also a registered nurse, and I've seen the ups and downs of staffing shortages. This one is different because it's all staff. It's not just nurses. So I'm happy to report, though, dietary is doing better. Now nursing assistants are our big, big challenge. We did an across-the-board wage increase this month in October in anticipation of the increase. We will be doing more, though, because we have to look at every department and find out where are we out of sync and really take some time to study it and make it really work for our care center. It's our intention to bring the entry-level workers up to a more livable wage and to make our nurses' pay more competitive with what the hospitals pay. We won't get competitive, but more competitive. We will continue to invest in our workforce in the years to come as we want to become and remain competitive. While we have taken advantage of the nursing scholarship program in the past, we are excited about the changes for RNs. We have a particular high need for RNs because we have a 100-bed transitional care unit. Last June of 2014, the hospital started taking our nurses with 3 months' experience. Before that, it was 12 to 18 months. This created a tremendous shortage of nurses for us last summer and has continued. So giving RNs a scholarship, giving them loan forgiveness for the new grads that come to us that we're able to hire is actually going to help us retain. And while I'm on the scholarship, I can think right off the top of my head of two of my nurse managers who started as nursing assistants. Then they became LPNs, RNs, and now are running the units in my center. Growing a nurse with the scholarship program are the nurses that tend to stay in your facility. They're not the ones that run to the hospital right away. So I would think it would be just very, very much a hurt to the industry to take that scholarship away. In fact, I'm very excited that it's expanded now for our RNs. Another area that we're investing in is a half-time position for the new year for a person to coordinate all of our clinical internships and clinical opportunities. Right now, we take about 200 students a year from a variety of programs. We work with St. Olaf, St. Kate's, Normandale, Rasmussen College, Hennepin Technical College, and all of these. That takes a lot of time to coordinate them, and we think we can do more with that position because we're really trying to get new workers into the industry for us and for the industry. One of the new initiatives we just started and are partnering with Bloomington Schools. We've partnered with them for years, but there's a new initiative. They have a new program called the Career and College Academy, where high school kids are getting high credit from Normandale for taking different career paths. There's four career paths, one of which is healthcare. There are 24 students in this. And the Masonic Home directors are going out to the school, and we're teaching a class once a week on different health care opportunities. We're offering job shadowing and mentoring for these students. We are offering a site visit, and we hope to get potential volunteers and encourage young people to move into this career. This is what this halftime position will be able to devote their time to trying to get more people in. We are a very large campus, and we believe that we have more resources than many, and we need to share those with the industry. So we're really excited about this new healthcare program. The gentleman running it ran one in the Rochester area, and he hopes to have that up to 200 students within a year or two. So we're excited about that, because right now there are not nursing assistants. While we're deeply appreciative of the efforts of the legislature last year to provide a stable source of funding for nursing facilities, we still are facing a very severe workforce shortage. There was a September article that came out this year in the Society for Human Resource Management magazine that was just dropped in my office yesterday of the 10 toughest jobs to fill in 2016. We have three of them in our industry: RN, physical therapy, and aides, nursing assistant home health aides. And we are feeling it in the industry. There's a couple of trends I see that in education that are really exacerbating the shortage of nursing assistants. First, the move of the four-year degree nurses. There's a move to have only four-year degrees. In fact, St. Kate's has just announced that they're dropping their two-year program for RNs. The four-year nurse is a wonderful thing to have, but, you know, we really can't afford a four-year RN in long-term care, and we need RNs. So we need two-year RNs. We need LPNs. The other thing that's really hurting us is the LPN programs and the RN programs in the last year or two have stopped requiring that their students be nursing assistants. That is a killer to us. Number one, it was a pool of employees to be nursing assistants that are no longer there. But secondly, as a nurse, I was an aide. You're a better nurse if you were a nursing assistant, and particularly in long-term care. They need to have that hands-on care piece. So if there's anything you could do to incentivize these programs to keep their two-year programs, to require that they be nursing assistants in the nursing programs, it would really help our industry. In closing, I want to thank you again for your support of the long-term care and nursing facilities this past legislative session. What we really appreciate is the flexibility that you've granted us to how to best allocate the resources is very appreciated, as we all have different pressing needs. We are very thankful that we have the ability now to look at our center and our needs and prioritize the money where it needs to go, most of it workforce. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Wiggin, for your testimony today. If you can stand by, too, for questions a little bit later. Next, we have Sharon St. Mary, the Executive Director for Metro Minnesota Good Samaritan Society. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and give us your testimony.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Sharon St. Mary. I'm the Executive Director for the Metro Minnesota Good Samaritan Society, so I specifically oversee seven of our homes in the metropolitan area, and I am also, for the last 7 months, temporarily the administrator of our Stillwater facility. So I will speak to that specific facility for much of my testimony. I want to start by saying thank you so very much for your investment in seniors and their caregivers this past year, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on the changes we are making following the passage of the nursing facility payment reform legislation earlier this year. Good Samaritan facilities across the state plan to make use of the new funding in a lot of different ways, depending upon market pressures and staffing needs and physical plans and the market activities in their particular location. As I said, I'm going to talk today about how the Good Samaritan Society Stillwater has been immediately impacted by the legislation and the changes we have made and that we intend to make to increase our wages and benefits for our workers, to improve the quality of care for the seniors and their families that we serve, and hopefully these will have an effect of providing a greater amount of stability in the workforce and some improvements to our facility. So after the legislation was passed in May, we sat down and we did, the first thing we did actually was we did a market comparison to find out what were the wages in the area. And for us, that included not only in our immediate geographic area, but then across the Twin Cities. We looked at what our other providers were actually paying, what the care providers of Minnesota and our partner organizations' wage survey. We looked at the information from Deed, and then we took a look at our own hiring scale. And our hiring scale is what we use to recognize experience and provide experience credit for new employees as they come in. And of course, our hiring scale hadn't been changed for a good long time because we didn't have fresh revenue coming in, so it needed to change very significantly. So once we did all of that, we determined where we needed to be competitive, and we changed our hiring scale. And then I sat down and looked at every single staff member in my facility, where they were currently with their wages, how long they worked for us, did they have any experience credit before they came that we had recognized, and then I plotted them on our new salary grid because I didn't want to hire somebody brand new coming into the facility and pay them more than I had paid a long-term, very loyal employee because that's just not a good thing to do. So for my employees, that there were about five of them that were above the scale, and so those people I gave a blanket across-the-board percentage increase to. But for all the rest of my employees, their salary increases averaged about $3 an hour. So it was very significant. And when you have the opportunity to sit and talk to each one of your staff, and I mean every single one of your staff, and tell them that you're able to give them a salary increase, which we did in July in advance of the money even coming our way, the very first person I talked to looked at me with shock in her face, and she said, "This is life-changing." And I thought, oh, my God, I've never had that much of an impact on anyone's life before that they said that to me. And that profoundly affected me. I didn't have one staff member, even the staff members who got a lousy 1% increase, complain. I didn't have one person say, gosh, is that it? They were all profoundly grateful. And so I want you to know that also because you're the people that made that happen for them. They are profoundly grateful. We're also doing things like having the luxury at this point in time to take a look at bringing back positions that, you know, through attrition we just didn't replace because we didn't have the money to do that. And, you know, when you do that over time, one person's job suddenly becomes one person doing the job of 10 people. And at some point in time, there's just no good end for that because one person can't do the job of 10 people and do them all effectively. And then the people that suffer at the end of that in quality are our residents and our families and our staff, too. They get burned out. We're going to be having to do some cosmetic remodeling to our facility because I'm sorry to say, have pink walls and pink carpet in one area of the building, which was like from 1984. At some point in time, even though it sometimes feels like a luxury to recarpet or replace your flooring and paint your walls, really, when it's pink, you want to do that because it's not a good color to live in. So those are some of the things. And then health insurance. I want to touch on health insurance for just a minute. Now, I've been very lucky because I'm part of a very large corporation, and the Good Samaritan Society has always provided health insurance for its employees. But one of the things that we're able to do going forward is we're actually because we have a three-level plan, and the lowest level plan is a high-deductible plan. And we haven't changed that or added that. But what we have been able to do is actually create an HSA, and we're actually contributing money into that for the employee, to help that plan be more affordable for them. And that's the first time that we've ever done that. So we're going to be contributing $500 per employee, and if they're on the family plan, $1,000. So that's a pretty significant amount of money. I think in closing, the thing that I want to say, two things, actually. One is that we have sent in all of my facilities an incredible number of students through school on the scholarship program. And I echo what my predecessors have said. I have a lot of long-term staff that work in my buildings that started as CNAs 35 years ago and are my directors of nurses, are my program managers, are my nurse managers. My MDS coordinator roller skated into the facility from the University of Minnesota when she was 19 years old as a CNA. And she has now just gone through school. She's become an RN. She's become our MDS coordinator, and now she's in training to be our manager of our post-acute unit. So I know that it sometimes feels like maybe 69% retention isn't a lot, but that's 69% of staff that I haven't lost. And that's important because when I look at the labor shortage right now, what I see is a crisis of resource. when you have the lowest unemployment rate in the country, there aren't people. And right now, I can get more nurses by stealing from someone else. So, and someone else can get my nurses by stealing from me. So when you have a limited number of resources, all you're doing is shoving them around into different places. So our crisis is, where do we find additional people to bring into that resource pool? And how do we do that? And how do we encourage that? And how do we make that happen fast enough? Because my shortage is today. I'm not taking admissions in my facility because I don't have a night nurse on some of my shifts, and my managers have been working it, which I'm profoundly grateful for. But so our crisis of resources today, and I'm thankful that, I'm thankful that you are here and that you have a committee that is addressing the healthcare workforce, because it is, I think, something very serious that we all need to work together to figure out a solution for. So once again, I will just end by thanking you for your support of long-term care this legislative session. Quality care is best provided with a consistent, stable workforce, and this investment will definitely help ensure that Minnesota seniors, and I am soon to be one of them, will get the, and I will be demanding, let me just say that, we'll get the kind of care that we want. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. St. Mary, for your testimony today. Mm-hmm. Next, we have Carol Roth, Vice President of Senior Services at St. Francis Health Services. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, co-chairs, Representative Mack and Representative Schumacher, and members of the Joint Committee for Workforce, for the opportunity that you've given me to share with our organization's gratitude and our experiences prior to and after the implementation of the value-based reimbursement system. My name is Carol Roth. I am the successor CEO of St. Francis Health Services of Morris, which many of you may know is about 3 hours west of the metro area and approximately 45 miles east of the South Dakota border. We are a faith-based multi-site organization with 12 care centers, 8 assisted living communities, and approximately 80 group homes. We employ over 2,500 greater Minnesota individuals. I and the 1,500 skilled nursing facility employees are deeply appreciative of the action taken in the last legislative session. You will hear from me in a moment as to what effect your actions have had on us. First, just a little bit of history. Because we are short on time, I'm going to cut this down and you'll have this information available to you. St. Francis leadership became acutely aware of the declining demographics of potential employees, probably because we're located in the rural Minnesota area many years ago. In the fall of 2013, we submitted an application to Minnesota Department of Human Services for a performance-based incentive program called the PIP grant. And that grant was focused on employee recruitment, selection, and retention. Thankfully, we were awarded a grant to allow us to implement a program to improve our residents' quality of care and their quality of life through development and enhancement of our nursing staff, specifically in recruitment, retention, and reducing nursing staff turnover. We know that reducing nursing staff turnover will reduce the number of inexperienced employees that lack efficiency in their service, thereby improving the quality of care for our residents. We also know that improving the consistency of caregivers allows relationships and bonding to occur between caregivers and residents, resulting in more comforting and regularity in cares. A 2014 article by the American Nursing Association, I won't go into it, but if we all agree that turnover is costly, I think that gets me beyond a few paragraphs. Our turnover at the beginning of our project, which was a baseline period of the year ended 9/30/13, at St. Francis, turnover was at an all-time high for us of 59.59%. The following year, as we expected, it was worsened to 66.7%, and we just calculated the numbers for the first year of the project, 9/30/15, at 65%. So our goal in the project was to have an improvement from that baseline of 5%, so it would be right around 57.8%. We have a lot of work to do. I don't think anyone in the room would be surprised to hear that nursing assistants have the highest turnover for us at about 75%. So three-quarters of the people that walk in our building leave our building before the end of the year. That's amazing to me. In 2013, one of our locations actually received a citation, F353, Nursing Services, Sufficient Nursing Staff. This was new to us. We've always prided ourselves on tracking our staffing levels, and we have always exceeded the allotted care-related portion of our rates. We do a very long calculation to make sure that we get every penny that we can to in our nursing care-related staffing. And, in fact, on average, our staffing analysis reports indicated that we'd run our staffing levels at probably 10 full-time equivalents over the current reimbursement rates that we were allotted prior to our new rate structure. Mandated hours and overtime is by far the most demoralizing component to our employee satisfaction, causing burnout and apathy. It's hard to care about your job when you're overworked, overburdened, and you can't get to the residents to provide care to them. Overtime has become our fastest growing operating cost. In calendar year 2013, St. Francis incurred 72,200 hours of overtime out of about 1 million hours a year at an additional premium of close to $500,000. This equates to 6.5% overtime hours in comparison to productive hours. Not too bad. We could live with that. Since then, our numbers have exploded. In fiscal year of 2014, St. Francis incurred 97,000 hours of overtime, and in 2015, we've had 121,000 hours of overtime. That's an increase of over 167%. So finding bodies is the challenge. That's the financial cost. The human cost on our residents of turnover and subsequent recruitment of nursing staff is extremely relevant at that level. So what impact does it have on our residents, family, and staff? Residents and their families have made it very clear to us that to our caregivers that they prefer consistent staff and lots of it. We monitor response times in each of our facilities, and it is a part of our resident satisfaction surveys. Staff respond promptly is consistently one of our lowest scores on our resident satisfaction surveys. An additional cost not often discussed is the human cost of turnover and subsequent recruitment on nursing staff. While a position is empty, the workload of that missing nurse must be absorbed into the other nursing workload. The remaining workers often need to work overtime to fill the shifts. Temporary employees require extra work by management nurses to provide support of those new employees as they become familiar with the environment. When a new nurse is hired, the nursing staff is very involved in orientation of that new nurse, so they get to spend less time providing the cares that they need to. This can result in decreased quality of care for the residents due to the negative impact on these residents when they lose individuals who understand their needs and desired routines as new employees lack the experience or knowledge of those resident preferences. Nursing turnover is financially costly. In 2013, several St. Francis facilities turned down new admissions due to not having adequate numbers of staff to care for additional residents. This reduces revenue, but it also creates a bad reputation in your community that you can't even support the residents that you are caring for. And since 2014, unfortunately, denying admissions has become the norm for many of our locations. A review of the St. Francis nursing facilities in January of 14 indicated RNs, LPNs, and NER turnover varied by the facility location and surrounding population. We found that if a facility is not located near a community college with a nursing and NER training program, the facility had a more difficult time hiring. In addition, if it was located near a hospital system in the rural areas, the nursing facility can't even compete with the wages. Our recruitment efforts were generic, broad, and virtually unresponsive at the time. But we also did not proactively seek out employees of different cultures or age groups. So that's why we entered the PIP grant when we did. And the PIP grant just ended its first year, so we're seeing some very positive results. I'm not here to talk about the PIP grant, though, so I'll go on to retention issues. At the beginning of the proposal, our retention at St. Francis was at an all-time low of 65.17%, with the lowest category of NERs at 58.5%. In 9 of 14, or the next calendar year, it dropped to 61.78%, and since 9:30 was just a couple of weeks ago, we have not been able to calculate what it is for 9:15, but I'm positive it was lower. I won't go into the reports that show and who actually quotes these citations, but RNs, LPNs, and nursing facilities have the lowest median tenure rate, typically less than a year. Our Minnesota report card scores for nursing assistant staff retention also verified the need for collaborative projects in this area. Our overall score was about 2.42, which was well below the state averages of 3.0. Our employee engagement survey outcomes consistently indicate that the following areas are most concerning for our employees: recognition of praise, pay, job stress, and burnout, and work progression. These areas are all a focus for us now, as you would expect. Use of temporary nursing staff is a thing of the past, because in the rural areas, even temp agencies can't find staff to provide services to you. And I had information about PIP grant. I'd love to share it with you, but I'm sure you can find it on the online systems. So having said all of this, value-based reimbursement couldn't have come at a better time. We estimated, utilizing information from Leading Age Minnesota, that our skilled nursing facilities cumulatively will receive just over $5 million over the 12-month period starting January 1 of 2016. provided that census stays the same as what it was in the cost report year of 9/30/14. Due to our experiences that I talked about, we committed to spending about 59% of those dollars to wage increases. As my predecessors indicated, there were other things that we needed to spend those monies on, too, because costs had increased for food, for utilities, for all of those other operational expenses that we weren't able to cover in the past either. However, I'm here to tell you today that we have actually, as of 10/14/15, our number right now of spending those funds, 91% of those available dollars have been spent on health care, insurance, wage increases, and pension incentives to help us recruit and retain employees. Prior to the Affordable Care Act, our locations did not offer health insurance to all of their employees. We couldn't afford it, much less at employee-paid portion that was affordable to them because we just didn't have the monies to do so. So typically health insurance was offered to management staff, or if it was offered to any other staff, it was at a premium reimbursement rate that the employee would have to pay that was unaffordable to them. This resulted in low utilization and, as you can guess, high premiums of that group, health insurance for that group. The Affordable Care Act changed much of that, as we were federally mandated to offer health insurance at an affordable rate, along with all of my peers in the state of Minnesota. However, without the monies in our rates to do so. So many of you may recall that I visited your offices in the spring of 2014 with a very lengthy letter and a very lovely spreadsheet that showed to you exactly what our situation was like. I was desperate to provide knowledge to all of you of what our situation was as a result of the federal mandate for the Affordable Care Act. We estimated that to fulfill that Affordable Care Act mandate, it would cost St. Francis $2.7 million. We implemented the health insurance as a result of the Affordable Care Act mandate because we did not want to be subject to the penalties that would be appropriated to us as a result of not doing that. Our plan at the time was to offer an affordable rate to our employees, but it wasn't pretty. Our plan was a high deductible $6,350 single and annual premiums paid by employees, which varied based on their wages. So it was a tier mechanism. It looked ugly. It was terribly ugly to implement, and we had very little utilization because, quite honestly, if you have to pay your health health cost, if you're making $10 an hour up to a $6,350 deductible, it really isn't helping out any health or any of our employees. And so it really became more of a catastrophic coverage for those individuals. Many did not take it because they could get state programs also, which sadly they qualified for them. And doing this still cost us $2.7 million. Most of our employees who didn't take our programs had to go out and could go out and find their own plans at a much lesser price, but then it didn't help us because they weren't taking the plan from us, and so our group plan was very expensive. So did I say that value-based reimbursement couldn't have come at a better time? We implemented our health insurance benefit effective September 1st of 15. We did a special enrollment, not waiting for the January 1 of 2016 year. With the health insurance benefit as a pass-through, we now have lowered our deductible from a $6,350 single and annual deductible to a $3,000 single and annual deductible. We've also lowered the hours required to meet the full-time status to match the Affordable Care Act of 30 hours a week. Previously, it was 70 hours in a two-week pay period. We've added a $150 health savings account monthly payment for all full-time employees working 30 hours a week, so a greater portion of their deductible of that $3,000 now can be paid out of those HSAs, and a portion of that HSA dollars can pay for some of those $6,350 deductibles that they had up until September 1st when we changed the deductible to $3,000. We did this retroactively for the HSA to January 1 of 2015 so that we could help them build their HSA up. Also starting 9/1 of 15, where we could, union negotiations have prevented this in some cases, but for all effective January 1 of 16, we will pay 100% of the single premium for all full-time employees. Why did we do this? Because there's not enough money to compete with the hospitals for wages. I knew I couldn't compete in my rural areas with my hospital for those RNs and LPNs or those NER positions. So we needed the incentive that might make the difference. And consistent schedules, hours, and a great health insurance plan has proven just in the short time to have made a difference. It also provides an incentive for those who do not work 30 hours a week to become a full-time employee. Nothing helps you get that person to pick up an extra shift or get scheduled at 30 hours a week than saying you get free health insurance if you do this in our locations. So that was our motivation for our employees. One of our locations did not offer the pension plan at all that our other locations had been able to, because when we bought this facility, they did not have the rate structure that allowed them to offer that same pension plan. So we now have a 5% of your gross wages pension plan for all employees who work at least 1,000 hours, are over 21 years of age, and have 1 year of service. Another location was not competitive in their shift differentials or cook differentials, so we made changes in that area. Most importantly, all of our locations prior to the VBR could not offer a wage that would incent staff from hospitals or fast food chains or schools. In fact, many of our NERs met the guidelines for state programs because of the wages they were paid. So we've also increased care-related wages at an average of about $1 per hour. LPNs and RNs might be higher, NERs a little bit lower. And we're marketing all of this information. Part of our PIP grant was to be able to market our wages and our employee programs in a better way so that we could meet those different culture groups and those different age groups. So a couple of comments that I wanted to share with you. We meet on a quarterly basis with all of our administrators and our directors of nursing, and I asked them to bring information and responses from those employees as to what difference it made in their lives. I've got 12 different employees, so I'm going to close in 5 minutes, or 2 minutes. 2 minutes, I promise. We went from 34 open shifts to 3 open shifts. We have 3 nurses from a hospital that came to our nursing homes because of the group health insurance plan, and I won't go on, but I've got a whole page full of very positive comments. So in closing, when I say thank you, I mean it sincerely. In my 30 years of employment in healthcare, I've never had the opportunity to provide the enhancements we have in this last year. And early indications through the 915 of enrollment have given us a reason to believe that it's made a difference. We've seen our numbers of participating employees increase by 62% due to the 30-hour threshold, 158% due to the better benefit. Invite me back after January 1 of 2016, and I'll give you a further update. I leave you with this. What can we do for our employees of the home and community-based services arena?
Thank you, Ms. Roth, for your very detailed testimony today. We very much appreciate it. And if you want to submit your testimony to the commission as well, we can take it to finish the rest of that. Thank you. Next, we have Mark Anderson, President and CEO of Newton Nelson in Alexandria. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, everyone. I want to thank you for allowing me to testify at your Commission on Healthcare Workforce. I am Mark Anderson, the President and CEO of Knute Nelson. We are a nonprofit, faith-based organization serving aging adults with the Continuum Services based in Alexandria, Minnesota. But our work expands 29 counties in the west central region of Minnesota and is accomplished by having also 10 home care offices and two hospice offices within that geography. Last year, we served 5,600 people throughout our services, and it could be in wellness or home care, multiple choices for housing, and as well as skilled nursing. As you see, we serve Minnesotans in a variety of settings. We are the fifth largest employer in Alexandria with 525 staff members there. I, too, want to start by extending a big thank you for enacting the nursing home payment reform that passed this last legislative session. I believe without this increased reimbursement that we will be receiving in January, it would have made the long-term viability of the nursing home very difficult to sustain. I believe that this new reimbursement is truly a part of identifying a longer-term solution for aging older adults in Minnesota. Over the last years, our organization at times has had to downsize bed or limit admissions purely because we were unable to find enough caregivers to ensure we could provide quality care. As I've said, we've had extreme challenges at time finding employees. Oftentimes we could have up to 50 open positions. In July of this year, however, ahead of the new legislation taking effect in January, we have been raising wages for direct care staff, particularly nursing assistants, and our licensed and registered nurses in order to recruit and retain them. In our area of Minnesota, unemployment rates have been consistently low causing greater competition for workforce in all industries, from manufacturing to food service to tourism to finding caregivers. The caregiver vacancy rate about 7-8 months ago, last time it was measured, was about 14%, with that's including nursing assistants, LPNs, and registered nurses. I think that vacancy rate is clearly going higher at times, although particularly in the CNA area. As you know, each job opening is significant because our work is dependent upon having caregiving staff to provide care to older adults we serve. This payment reform system will now allow us to be on a more sustainable path, so we'll be able to increase wages for our caregivers. As we look out to January 1st, different positions, we expect up to 13% increases for some of our positions in order to be competitive in the marketplace that we're in. We're striving to have livable wages and benefits for our employees that who, as a result, are able to care for Minnesotans. Beyond that, as I've heard earlier, we've also added new positions, particularly around quality, with the new reimbursement system to focus on quality and education throughout the nursing home beyond just wages. But I'm going to kind of not go into every statistic, but really talk about some other areas beyond wage for the committee. I want to talk about areas that help us recruit and retain a quality workforce. First, I want to say thank you for the enhancements that were made in the area of scholarships and the Loan Forgiveness Program. A significant area of funding priority is supporting scholarship programs for employees. We actively offer scholarships to all employees of Knute-Nelson. Last year, we contributed over $68,000 from our foundation in the Nursingship Scholarship Program. We believe this is a key component of attracting people to careers in long-term care. We are taking full advantage of these programs. Some scholarships we award nearly cover the cost of full tuition. We're intentional at this because of the talent we have on our staff and want them to continue to work for us. We are also excited to offer a loan forgiveness program to recruit nurses into long-term care. We believe these programs help us offer career ladders throughout our organization and give us greater opportunity to retain employees. These programs are fully a part of our recruitment efforts to attract employees. As you imagine, there are ongoing needs for additional scholarship dollars. I also believe that in order to have a sustainable workforce, we have to get people excited about healthcare careers at an early age. In this last year, we developed a collaborative that I'm very proud of, in which that included the Alexandria Area High School and the Alexandria Technical and Community College. This collaboration focused on bringing certified nursing assistant classes into the high school as part of their students' regular schedule. This fall, we were able to make this happen, offering the first CNA class right in the high school. This is the first certification program for students to achieve an industry recognition training and obtain college credit at Alexandria Area High School. We were able to set up a full healthcare lab for students to work and obtain real-life experience. We are limited to 20 students each semester due to clinical instruction, but what was exciting is the class filled up on day one right away, and there's a waiting list to get into the class, and I'm sure that the next semester's class will be as full as well. This class will not only help provide a workforce in the short term for nursing assistants, it will provide students with the first exposure to healthcare careers. This program equips students with valuable healthcare experiences with the possibilities of continuing their education and obtaining other advanced medical degrees. There are some costs associated to starting up the program, such as creating a lab, test outs of students in instruction time on a clinical basis. Thankfully, we were able to receive a grant through the West Central Initiative to get us started. I do believe this is an area where the legislature could truly help by funding the startup or ongoing costs of potentially CNA programs in high schools. I believe that by getting students excited about health careers, it is a start toward growing an adequate healthcare workforce equipped to handle today's challenge. I'm convinced that we need to be more intentional at encouraging youth to consider healthcare careers at an earlier point of time in their lives. Another area of concern for me is the current lack of available of licensed and registered nurses in the workforce. In our area, there simply are not enough licensed nurses to fill all the current needs. Currently, in our area, there are a few care centers in our region that are not admitting or very selectively admitting due to the lack of available licensed practical nurses. Clinics, as well as acute care clinics, are challenged to fill their LPN positions as well. I believe this is truly coming from supply and demand. We simply are not producing enough nurses in Minnesota to meet the growing demand for services. I would encourage this committee and the legislature to look for ways to expand the licensed nursing and registered nursing programs for our colleges and university systems. At the current rate of graduation, we simply do not have enough nurses to meet all the needs of Minnesotans. I often hear about the long waiting list to get into these programs, and I believe it is imperative that we find ways to fund the expansion of these programs. As a long-term care provider throughout the region, we have a critical role in the integration of healthcare services. The services we offer are what aging adults need and also what acute providers need to manage people's health. The workforce shortage is beginning to occur and is at really crisis stages, and the demand for care at the later stages of life only accelerates the need for having a well-trained and educated workforce. So in conclusion, I again want to say thank you for the Healthcare Workforce Commission. The legislation that passed this year is a very important step in developing a sustainable long-term workforce. I believe there are many opportunities on the horizon, some of that which I outlined in my testimony, that we can continue to work on to look at the need for greater healthcare workforce. I would encourage this commission to study some of those. Again, I want to thank you for your time today and all that you've done for long-term care.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson, for your testimony today. And your remarks transition very well into the adult basic education portion that we're going to move into now quickly. Just a note, Representative Mack just sent me a note that said that she will gavel out at noon with my head if we don't move forward quickly. So if the folks from adult basic education could come down and present briefly so that I can keep what little hair I have left, that would be much appreciated.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Pat Thomas, and I am with ABE, or Adult Basic Education, or what I call adult education, because basic's almost fallen out of the word now. I come from Marshall, Minnesota, so every one of the people that talk from Greater Minnesota totally can understand where they're coming from for the lack of people out there. And unless you guys become magicians, I don't think you're going to create more people to take these places. The only place that I see that we're going to be able to do anything about this is, first of all, is to address the high schools. And the second is to look at our immigrant and refugee populations and those who are underserved, which is my billywig over there. I've worked in adult education for 16 years, 12 years. I have worked in, are you folks familiar with Fast Track? Mm-hmm. All of you? Fast Track? Yes? Now it's called career pathway work and that type of stuff. I've worked with that for the past 12 years down in Marshall, and in the past 7 years, we have worked with people to get 249 CNA certificates out there, which is a pretty good number for our small area, which I would say over 70% were all minorities. I have asked that you be able to receive this. This is an article that I would encourage you to look at. Here is talking about those underemployed minorities or underemployed individuals and then our refugee and immigrant population. These are the folks that have used our program that are now working in our long-term cares down in the rural area down in Marshall. And I would also point out that due to the fact that we work very well with our employers, the employers also recognize that we will help get them the CNAs, then they pick them up from there, help them go forward to become LPNs and RNs. And we have many people who started as CNAs who have gone up and been LPNs and RNs. This sheet I would share with you. This points out kind of how the fast track model or the career pathway model works. in that we have the workforce system, adult education, and you have your community technical college working together to support people to be able to assist them so they can be successful in going through a CNA program. We work with other professions as well, welding, but CNA is where I work predominantly. And that describes the different roles that each one of them have. Now, the one thing, you, like I say, I don't think you're going to go out there and hocus pocus more people. So what are some of the solutions that could be used? Well, they talked about the high school people. Our program down in Marshall, where we do fast track, which normally only includes adults, we are doing it with high school students. So we're able to have a more robust program, and we're able to offer it more often. So I would suggest that possibly might be a solution. Looking at combining the fast track, working with your high schools, how can we work together and become more efficient? Then what I would also suggest here, this was a piece of legislation that sometimes, you know, it can be put forward. You think it's going to show up, and then it doesn't as the law is finally signed. What this is, and it's kind of piggybacks off your scholarship discussion that you had earlier. Currently, the individual, if I go in, take my CNA, the facility will reimburse me back for the cost of my tuition to have gone through the class. What we are asking here is that adult education entities be also eligible entities to receive that reimbursement. If you look at it, you're saying we're asking for 30% over the fixed costs. And the reason we have that in there is when we put someone through a CNA, first of all, we're bringing them up, we're enhancing their math scores, their computer scores, making sure their literacy is at the rate they're going to succeed. Then when that person goes in and takes their CNA, our adult education instructor is in the classroom with the college instructor to assist any of the students who are having any difficulty or challenges with the material. That's why our success rate of getting people through the program is at probably around 95% of our people pass the CNA if they're going through our program because of the additional help. The other thing that I would suggest that this committee might be interested in considering is, again, you're not going to make any more people out there. We've got to provide an avenue in which refugees and immigrants and residents of our state who are underemployed to help them move forward. Right now, when we do assessments, if the person has, and it's called CASAS, if they come in at a 230 level, we can get them through a CNA program with the additional support we give them. I am recommending that we consider we create content which would be online, that would be written at a 5.5 reading level up to an 8.5 reading level, that the intent of the content would be to help raise people's literacy scores, and that the only material used within creating the content would be healthcare and CNA related. Now, we on our website have a reading program that's known for its effectiveness nationally. I am proposing that if we are going to bring more people into the field, what we have to do is we have to tap into this resource of our immigrants and refugees. At a 5.5 reading level, up to a 7th grade reading level, they have enough language. They can go out there and get a job. And they get the job so they can put food on the table. But many have the passion. They would like to go into health care. And I am suggesting if we could create some content, which would be called contextualized content in the healthcare field that adults could see as it being truly relevant, that if I want to be a CNA and I want to go into healthcare, this is a tool I could use, and that as I go through that thing, I would then be able to be picked up by a CNA fast track program to be able to attain my CNA. This content, like I suggest, would be online, and it would be something available at every ABE program, because if we created this, and of course I do have to mention there is no money to create this wonderful thing, but if we ever created it, the adult education programs would snap that up. They would be using it statewide, and I do believe it would be used nationally, because there is nothing out there right now for these populations that want to move forward in healthcare that's only got healthcare content. Rather, ESL is taught where you're learning TV, piece of paper, pen. It's more of a shotgun approach, and so I'm recommending is a thought towards creating something specifically with the aim of getting more people into the healthcare field. And that would be all I have to say, I think.
Thank
unless
you
had any questions.
Ms. Thomas, and if anyone has any questions, they'll probably have to grab you after the hearing today. We do have two more testifiers on the adult basic education that we'd like to hear from as well, the International Institute and Health Force. If you could please make your way forward and introduce yourself to the commission.
Can someone pass these?
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment while we're waiting.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Just a request to our chairs here, if maybe the next meeting, if we have testifiers who are traveling in, maybe we could put them first on the agenda, give them a time limit. But I think our agency and our staff people who are here all the time can be at the end. But I really want to be sure we get them in. But maybe we, just a suggestion, maybe put them first on the agenda.
Thank you. All right.
My name is Michael Donahue. I'm the Associate Director and the Director of the Medical Careers Pathway at the International Institute of Minnesota. We are one of five refugee resettlement agencies in the state. We sponsor the Festival of Nations, but what I'm here to talk about is our focus on education and job training. So what started 25 years ago with five Southeast Asian refugees at Ling Bloomston Care Center on the first day of class for nursing assistant training has grown into a 300-student pathway program as of this year. I'll try to summarize what I've handed out to you so that you can see what we have added over that time in order to fill in the gaps to provide service for our refugee and immigrant clients. So the first page of what I handed out to you, the latter, that's kind of a logical descriptor of what we do. Chronologically, the four stages here started in a different order. So I'll just talk briefly about from the bottom rung of the ladder up. So we started a few years ago a pre-nursing assistant training program to keep people who were unable to pass our entrance test interested in the field. We were losing them. They would never come back to us. So you can see just in summary, that would be a class that focuses by using medical language and medical concepts on the skills that are lacking in reading, listening, writing, and computers. It's really the medical careers pathway highlight. The second stage is the nursing assistant training. So since that first class in 1990, we have enrolled more than 2,500 refugees and immigrants to be trained as nursing assistants. We have a 90% completion rate for that 8 or 11 week training program. And of all those who complete and graduate from the program, we have a 98% success rate in getting our students certified as nursing assistants. Part of what was so successful over the years was the recognition that second language learners, refugees and immigrants who've come to us, need a lot more time than native speakers in order to integrate all of this knowledge. We use the Minnesota approved curriculum for nursing assistant training. And you can see on the back page of what I handed out to you, the third page, that in addition to kind of a rewritten version of that curriculum approved by the state for second language learners, supplementing all of that with significant ESL support. The nurse instructor and the ESL instructor work as a team in presenting all of the information in each unit. We then added that whole variety of modules that are a combination of job readiness, cultural awareness, and financial literacy. It's what makes the program, in my opinion, so successful, that our students are not just given the academic knowledge that they need with the ESL support, but they learn what it's like to be a member of the workforce in the United States. That program educates about 144 students every year. Maybe 135 of them each year get certified as nursing assistants. And this past year have been hired by more than 65 long-term care facilities. One of our clinical training sites, St. Anthony Park Home in St. Paul, they have roughly 60 nursing assistants across all shifts, and 45 of them are graduates of our program. They learn what I tell people all the time, that our students, not denigrating native-born students, but our students are born taking care of the elders in their families and in their communities. That we don't teach them. What we teach them is how to get certified and how to learn the ropes of moving into that workplace. We then learned after about 10 years that some of our graduates were interested in moving up the career ladder, and we explored a number of different possibilities for them, and quickly learned that they were not able to do that on their own. And so we developed and added to the pathway of the college readiness training, now called the College Readiness Academy. So this uses college-level instruction in reading, listening, college study skills, computer proficiency, in order to prepare our students for college. We have entered into an agreement with St. Paul College in particular in this regard to form the academy together with the Hub Center and Neighborhood House in order to offer these classes for students. Our theory, which has been proven, I won't talk about it right now, through a couple pilot programs, is that not everyone needs developmental education. That with some assistance, or with at least a minimal amount of DevEd, that they can succeed well in higher education and attain their goals. And so that's what we're working on in the College Readiness Academy. About 3 years ago, the one pilot program that was so successful was the anatomy and physiology class at St. Paul College. The majority of second language learners who were taking that course failed and then had to wait at least a year before they could take that course again. So we used the fast track model that Pat referred to earlier, and we added a bridge course for these students before they even went to day one of the college class, and gave an overview of what that course was about, and then had the institute instructor sit in with the instructor for the class, and then provide an hour of additional support class after each of the A and P classes during the semester. And you can see the statistics and the outcome of that on the middle page that I handed out, on the back part of that middle page. For a class where the majority of the students were failing, What we found out was that with that added assistance over five semesters, 100% of all of our students who received that additional bridge and support help not only passed the class, but passed the class 74% of them with A's and 26% with B's. It was a remarkable accomplishment for those students. And we're going to be continuing that same type of outreach with some of the other required courses in the LPN diploma program at St. Paul College. Health, human body systems, the very TEAS test that's required for students to get into nursing programs. We've now created a special study class to help students get through that in order to be accepted into the nursing programs. And then that all leads into the final step, is the medical career advancement. So we have staff who are able to work with our students and help them navigate through that whole system. You can imagine if you spent 17 years of your life, as some of our refugee students did, living in refugee camps, the shock of trying to deal with the higher education system in the United States. Navigation is so key at all levels, not just at this level, but at the college readiness level, in addition to learn how to survive in the world of higher education. And so we work with students all through this process. You see on the handout some of the particular outcomes from the past year. Over the course of the 15 years that the Medical Career Advancement Program has been in operation, we have helped 390 of our students achieve medical career upgrades, mostly in registered nursing and licensed practical nursing, and now in the new field of phlebotomy that we're working on. Just a few more highlights to kind of summarize this. In terms of retention, some of the issues that have been spoken to earlier, what we know about our students is that they tend to stay much longer in the workplace. So for the United Way reports that we do every year, we call every student who has been placed in the preceding years. And what we find in the middle of that page, you can see the six-month retention rate for our refugee and immigrant students in the long-term care industry is 94%. That's almost unheard of in the industry. And we were able to contact 95% of all of our graduates. So that's a lot of people who are staying on in the long term. The 12-month retention rate is 92%, also very high. So that, in summary, is what we do in order to help the newest Americans among us move into the healthcare field and succeed. It requires a lot more time and a lot more patience and a lot more support. But we know that when that is provided, when that navigation help is provided along every step of the way, that the refugees and immigrants who are now part of our community can succeed very well. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Donahue, for your testimony today. To conclude today's hearing, we will hear from Valerie DeFore with Health Force. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Valerie DeFore. I'm the Executive Director of Health Force Minnesota, and I'm pleased to share with you the work that we are doing in the realm of healthcare workforce. There's a mismatch here. So we are the organization that led the Mental Health Workforce Plan, which was submitted to the legislature on January 15th of this year. You have an executive summary in your folder. This work was done using a large steering committee, made up of experts in the field. These members represented mental health professionals, state agencies, licensure boards, associations, public and private educational institutions, advocacy groups, providers, and even legislators. So, Senator Claussen, we continue to be grateful for your participation. 9 of the 24 recommendations in the Mental Health Workforce Development Plan have been implemented in whole or in part. We are also the organization that houses and started the Clinical Coordination Partnership. Again, you have this in your folder, which is making a real difference in the efficiency of scheduling clinical education experiences. With over 100 clinical and education partners, TCCP has transformed the clinical scheduling process. We're the organization that leads the Clinical Laboratory Work Group for the state of Minnesota, which has been working since 1998 to ensure a well-trained laboratory workforce for our state. We recently completed our third statewide summit in St. Cloud at the end of September, attended by over 80 laboratory leaders and educators who came together to discuss workforce challenges in the laboratory. We are the organization that holds Scrubs Camps throughout Minnesota, and you have some flyers and information on Scrubs Camps in your folder. Thanks to the contributions of many partners, including many of our long-term care partners, our acute care hospital systems, organizations, higher education institutions, foundations, and employers, we have been able to award 50% of our campers scholarships to attend that camp. That really helps us meet our goal of reaching underserved middle school and high school students to participate in Scrubs camps. During camp, students get to really envision themselves in a college setting. They get to learn about health careers, and they get to begin to dream a dream. And we just see light bulbs go off every session, every day of our Scrubs camps. We have created, in a strong partnership with others, the healthcare core curriculum for Minnesota. The healthcare core curriculum is very entry-level content designed to help students in high schools or in colleges who say, I'm interested in healthcare, but might not know much beyond that. So very entry-level content that will support them along any career pathway that they would choose in the healthcare field. We are also the organization that provides consultation services to our MNSCU nursing programs, assisting them as they pursue and proceed with accreditation requirements. In the nursing field, we are also leading a new partnership around the use of simulation in healthcare education, which I know Senator Kiffmeyer referenced earlier. That leadership and that work will involve creating a consortium of educators and providers who are using simulation to enhance and supplement clinical education in our nursing programs. We'll be able to share best practices and scenarios and expertise in that field. We are also a partner in the Ecumen Project, which is really looking at increasing recruitment and retention of nurses in rural Minnesota. HealthForce Minnesota is the organization that is advised by the HEIP Partnership Council. The council brings together educators, employers, state agencies, and associations to identify workforce challenges and solutions in the healthcare sector. The Partnership Council actually predates HealthForce Minnesota. It has been meeting quarterly since 1998. With an average of 35 members attending each quarterly meeting, the council has proven to be an invaluable source of expertise, networking, and collaboration. And it's actually seen as a model in other states throughout the country. Looking ahead, HealthForce will continue to develop, grow, and replicate all of the work that I've highlighted. New initiatives will focus on the healthcare core curriculum, including utilizing it as a nursing assistant curriculum in an online, asynchronous manner, which we believe will help meet the needs of our long-term care partners with recruiting people into the CNA field. We're working on developing a CTE licensure program in healthcare in partnership with one of our MNSCU universities. We're planning 16 Scrubs camps for 2016, and you have a flyer of future Scrubs camps in your folder. We're looking forward to continuing to work on the mental health recommendations and have identified three that HealthForce will take the lead or co-lead on. These recommendations involve career pathways, rural access to education programs, and improving cultural competencies within the field. And since my response to questions about the future need for healthcare workers in Minnesota is that we haven't stopped getting old and we haven't become miraculously well, I know Health Force will be called upon to take on new initiatives that really aren't even on our radar screen right now. Thank you.
I'd like to thank all of our presenters today. Your information has been very useful, very helpful as we move ahead with our commission study. Co-chair Mack had to leave for a meeting. I am due up at the Minnesota Department of Ed at 1 o'clock for a meeting. And so any comments from any panel members? Yes.
I just have, and since our testifiers are here, I just have some quick questions, and I'll just name them. And maybe they could just email me. And one of them is, do they offer continuing education units, CEUs, without charge to their employees on site? Ms. Wiggin in particular mentioned that. Ms. Ra, on the HSA, is that a carryover HSA, or is that use it by the end of the year HSA? And then for Mr. Anderson, in regards to some of your loan forgiveness, some other stuff. Do you have a requirement built into this as far as them staying within your system or in the specific location? Those are three areas that any one of them could maybe respond to.
Very good. Thank you, Senator. I think, too, if some of our presenters are willing to stick around, members of the commission here would be available or would like to speak with you as well. So hearing no other comments, I'm going to adjourn.